This is NPR's All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Robert Siegel. In recent years, a number of books have come out about the KGB, based on the KGB's own documents. There was the decryption of the Venona file, Soviet-coded cables that were sent from Washington to Moscow in the 1940s. Later, the American historian Alan Weinstein and the former KGB agent Alexander Vasiliev wrote The Haunted Wood, based on the KGB's own archives. Other researchers have been given access to some of the KGB's files. But Christopher Andrew's source is colossal. Andrew, who's a Cambridge University historian, has written The Sword and the Shield, a history of the KGB that has revealed former spies in Britain, France, and other countries. His source is a voluminous collection of information smuggled out of the KGB archives by one of the agency's own employees, Vasily Mitrokhin.
He was an archivist. He had become a dissident after the Prague Spring, like a number of other people. 1972, he is given the job of transferring the whole Foreign Intelligence Archive of the KGB from its cramped headquarters in central Moscow to a nice new greenfield site in the new headquarters in Yasenovo. And this process takes 10 years. And every day during that period, he notes material and he gets it out at the end of the day. Now, how do you do so? As the result of a blindingly obvious failure of security. But since nobody had done it before, I suppose it didn't occur to them. At the new place, they have bag searches. Your bags on a random basis are checked in and out, but they have no body searches. So these notes, which he took every day, every working day for the 10 years of the transfer, and then for two more years afterwards leading up to his retirement, he takes them out in his pockets. It was as simple and as unbelievable as that.
How many pages in the end had he removed from the archives? That it, not actual KGB documents, but his own notes about those documents.
It covers the whole period from the 20th of December 1917, when the Cheka forerunner of the KGB was founded, up to the eve of Gorbachev coming to power in the mid-1980s. He didn't, of course, have time to note everything, but he had access to and the possibility of noting every single, not 99%, but 100% of the Foreign Intelligence Archive.
And you were given exclusive access to work with Mitrokhin and to make this book out of it. First of all, who gave you that access?
Vasily Mitrokhin. You know, he risked his life for this stuff. There's no exaggeration about that. You know, it would have been a bullet in the back of the head after a summary trial and any single day that he'd been found doing this. The only conditions on which he agreed to defect to Britain in 1992 was that, you know, it was understood that the material was going to come out.
As someone who had already written about the KGB and who had written about intelligence, when you gained access to this extraordinary, illicit archive of the KGB, what were the beelines you made? What were the first questions you had about seeing and checking to see what Mitrokhin's documents said?
Well, let me just give you one or two examples. The KGB as was, the SVR as now is, current Russian Foreign Intelligence, since he's come out, has been releasing some of its own files. They're the less sensitive files. In every case, that material has checked out against his notes and transcripts of the original. Just one example of that. You know, everybody from time to time is going to make an error of transcription. The error that I thought he'd made in one document was that he says that, the British spy, alas, from my university, Cambridge University, Guy Burgess, when one of his friends from Oxford, Garon Wiris, in 1939, decides not to spy for the Soviet Union any longer, according to Vasily Mitrokhin's notes, it says that Burgess asked for him to be assassinated. Well, I just thought that he might have transcribed the wrong word, but no, lo and behold, when that file was declassified in the Soviet Union as was, the Russian Federation as now is last year, it said exactly that, assassinated. That's just one of many examples in which the material checks out in ways that Mitrokhin could not possibly have anticipated.
Tell the story of the KGB's efforts to either enlist, I'm not sure which it is, to enlist or to discredit Zbigniew Brzezinski when he was the National Security Advisor to President Carter.
Well, they are simply pathetic. The problem is simply this, that the KGB had penetrated during the Second World War every branch of the Roosevelt administration. Now, during the Cold War, it could never bring itself to admit that it could never do that kind of thing again. So it has to keep saying, oh, we've got this great scheme to recruit Brzezinski. And of course, they never have the slightest chance of coming up. But it gets so annoyed with Zbigniew Brzezinski when he declines to be recruited. I mean, I think its efforts were so fumbling that he may not even have realized that they were trying to recruit him, that they decide to discredit him by forging material which suggests that he had been working as a CIA agent for some time. Pathetic stuff. This was not the area in which they did well during the Cold War. There were areas in which they did very, very well in the United States. That was not one of them.
I want to ask you a question about assassination.
Yeah.
Why was it that in some cases, if the enemy of the Soviet state was Leon Trotsky, the exiled former rival to Stalin within the party, assassination was the preferred means of dealing with him? And yet, for other people, Yelena Bonner, for example, the wife of Andrei Sakharov, instead, it seems incredible effort is gone to defame her, to libel her, and to ruin her reputation. And Sakharov himself, perhaps the strongest moral force undermining Soviet rule, is sent off to the industrial town of Gorky, but not liquidated, as they said at one time. Do you see some rhyme or reason here as to why at some time some people are killed, but at other times that seems to not be an option?
Yes, I do. Assassination of enemies of the people, in other words, enemies of Joseph Stalin, is actually a central part of his foreign policy. There is a change in the early 1960s, so they go in for subtler tactics. So what they do is seek to destroy Sakharov by actually destroying his wife. They discover that Sakharov is able to take attempts to defame Yelena Bonner far less well than they can, he's able to take attacks on himself. So one example, 1980, they managed to plant in an Italian newspaper an article which has its headline, Academician Sakharov's Wife, in other words, Yelena Bonner, Academician Sakharov's Wife is guilty of a series of murders. Now, the important point to notice is that this is not just a nasty hobby. They never had, almost never had, any priority which was greater than making sure that any dissident who had fled abroad or been expelled abroad was miserable and unsuccessful. Now, that doesn't matter whether we're dealing with the great cellist Rostropovich. It doesn't matter whether we're dealing with the great writer Solzhenitsyn or the chess player Korchnoi or dissidents like Yuri Orlov who had wound up in the United States. It was a major, major priority to make sure that they failed in whatever they were doing, whether it was chess or writing.
Well, Christopher Andrew, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much for asking me.
Christopher Andrew is the author of The Sword and the Shield, The Matryokhin Archive and the Secret History of the KGB.